Welcome back to another episode of the Arcana Archives, a deep dive into nerddom. My name is Rogan, and my fun fact is, I have had the pleasure of working under today's guest in several interesting areas, including acoustics research, my shakuhachi concerto, and in the music publishing business. I'm joined here today by Chelsea, my co-host.
Hello, I have not had the pleasure of working with today's guests at all. In fact, I'm meeting her for the first time today. And my fun fact is I made ribs for the first time yesterday.
Oh, nice. And here we have Linda Schwartz as our very special guest today. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and a fun fact?
Thanks so much, Rogan and Chelsea. It's a delight to join you. And fun fact for me, I have been in deep mourning over the last 18 months because of the lack of professional football being live and operating in Canada. For those of you who may be listening from outside of Canada, I am a rabid fan of the Saskatchewan Rough Riders, and the Canadian Football League, the CFL, is what I live and breathe in my off hours. It's my Friday night therapy. I get to scream at the television, and every once in a while I do attend a game, none of which have taken place since the 2019 fall season. So I am very, very much looking forward to the start, albeit late, of the CFL in September of this year, and hope to see packed stands and lots of entertainment on Friday nights on the television.
Oh, that's awesome. I didn't know they were starting again. And
oh man, yeah, there's a lot of stuff to look forward to.
Yeah.
Training camp starts in July, so we're very, very excited for that. And I think it's going to be a very different league, and probably just lots of let's call it almost professional play, because it's been a lot of time since even the pros in the league have had any kind of practice with teammates.
So, Linda, why don't you give us a little bit of a background about yourself before we start getting into the questions we have for you today and what your topic is?
Sure. Yeah, happy to do that. From a kind of an educational vantage point, I have a number of degrees in music, both undergraduate in composition and a master's in composition from the University of Manitoba and Western University in Ontario, respectively. I then did all the coursework for a PhD in music theory, but interesting fact, I found that for political reasons, the dissertation project that I wanted to do was not acceptable within a given sort of music school context. So I waited. I went from the University of Minnesota, where I had completed all of this coursework in music theory, to the University of Manitoba, and found a new interdisciplinary PhD that specialized in special projects, and was able to gather a team of interdisciplinary scholars around me to complete that project. And if you want to know about that project and why it was considered off-limits or verboten by music schools, you can ask. Don't be shy.
I want to know.
Okay. It was a long road. It was a long road for me because I wanted to actually study music theory pedagogy. And to put that in very simple terms, I wanted to study the way in which music theory is taught to undergraduates. Because having done a number of courses in critical theory and in music aesthetics as it relates to art more broadly, I began to recognize that music in university, number one, is way behind other art disciplines in terms of incorporating theory into the language of the art form. And so students in music are not taught in their theory courses to critique their discipline, to have an understanding of what critical inquiry means, to be able to look at the tradition or the canon of so-called great works that have existed, and to primarily discover reasons for certain musics in the Western world being enshrined in a canon of what we now refer to as white German dead guys.
Yes.
This is a problem. And I was absolutely forbidden from taking up that kind of thesis 20 years ago.
Because they didn't want you to scrutinize what they were doing?
It would absolutely scrutinize and undermine what everybody was doing with undergraduates in their theory coursework. And Rogan knows this. He's been through this journey, partly with me. And not that I taught the canon religiously, but I basically stuck to the script, like everyone else. And so many of us have learned to teach the way that we were taught. But some of us are rebels, and we insisted on teaching some other things, not because we were taught them, but because we knew that it was critical for students in our classrooms to go out of our courses knowing something about the wider world and about how we deal with the notion of two musics, a classical canon lying alongside a kind of non-canonic music in our own tradition, not to mention the world of popular music, which had been already broached and engaged by cultural theorists, not music theorists, but also art theorists from a variety of spectrums. So it was important that they know the language. And I would dare say that 20 years from now, actually today, 20 years on, this is not an issue anymore. I've seen a number of theses that have come out and questioned the very thing that I wanted to do in the early 1990s. It just simply wasn't allowed. So, I was one of the first people to come out with a dissertation that actually looked at the canon, it looked at the history of music theory in the Western world, and it looked at what we teach and why we teach what we teach, and then why, as the big question, it simply wasn't permitted in music schools, and why we hoped that there would be an interstitial space between what critical theorists were doing in things like even new musicology and what music theorists were yet not doing in the early 90s.
I love that. What a cool career path you've had.
I was a little ahead of my time. So I had to actually find a program that would accept my proposal. And not only did the University of Manitoba accept the proposal, they actually awarded it with a doctoral fellowship, which simply means lots of money for all the years that you are doing coursework. They felt that the project was worthy, worthwhile, contemporary. It explored an important issue. And I was able to successfully complete my dissertation in 2008 and defend it in January of 2009. So it was a long road. I started my first PhD in 1989. And I took a little bit of a break after doing my oral exams and comprehensive written exams for University of Minnesota in 1995, and could not start the new program until 2001. So, yeah, long story short.
That's a big break.
I essentially have what the graduate dean at Manitoba told me. I essentially have the equivalent of three doctorates worth of coursework. They didn't make me do much coursework at Manitoba before I could start the dissertation, because I'd already done the equivalent of two PhDs worth of coursework in my doctorate at Minnesota. And a lot of that work was in cultural studies. The non-music stuff I did, I went straight to cultural studies because that's where I found the answers to a lot of the questions that I was seeking answers for in my own discipline and couldn't find. So there you
really
go.
Really fascinating.
You haven't heard that story before, have you, Rogan?
No, I don't think so.
No, I don't think that you were in any courses where I talked about this. So yeah, I don't regret it. I don't regret the journey one bit because it gave answers to me, not necessarily the answers I wanted, but it gave answers to me about why music theory is so divorced from critical musicology. And I've been delighted to see in the last 20 years where I haven't really been active as a scholar in music, I've been delighted to see music scholarship come together. These two fields are now almost so melded that you cannot tell whether the author is originally a music theorist or a musicologist. And that's a good thing. That's a very good thing. Because the disciplines are now asking the kinds of questions that they need to ask. And I have noted with interest that my dissertation has been quoted by a lot of people who were working in the early 2000s on the same kinds of questions that I was working on. And so it's not published by anybody. I haven't even gone to the lengths of turning it into a book. But that's likely going to be a retirement project since it focuses very, very strictly on why we teach music theory the way we do. And it's still being taught the same way it was being taught over 100 years ago in American universities. But it's very, very different from what is taught in Europe. I also discuss the reason for that in my dissertation.
I look forward to reading it when it is a book one day.
Hey, good. Yeah, that's encouraging. Thank you.
Love to get my hands on that as well. That definitely a lot of insight into exactly sort of how the North American music institution functions.
Well, and if I had a subtitle, Rogan, it's the title's long enough. It's kind of scary, so I won't go there. But if it had a subtitle that was comedic, and I know you would enjoy that, it would read something like "What We Do to Music Students in Theory Classes." And why? Because yes. it's really a game that is perpetrated on students so that the tradition continues, so that it carries on. There is a political agenda, and it's really no more than that. It's about survival of the music academic. Mm-hmm. And musicologists left that by the wayside a long time ago and separated themselves in the musicology field between three particular groups, what we call historical musicology, which is still very much canon focused, systematic musicology, which is essentially an understanding of the hows and whys of doing musicology, and the new musicology or critical musicology, which really started with some of my former teachers and mentors, including Susan McClary. Her name is associated with the new musicology. She's usually one of the first names that comes up in the list of those who decanonized music history in North American schools in particular. But her name, if you look her up and Google her, is everywhere. It's ubiquitous. And she is often considered the founder of the new musicology. So I have heard to blame for my journey.
Wow. Yeah, that's...
I'm glad it has been decanonized.
She opened up the Pandora's box for me of what was possible to ask. Of what was possible to ask in my first year of study in 1989. And I will never, ever regret it because it was instrumental for me in unlocking a lot of the questions that I had that remained unanswered. So, you know, I'm grateful to her for that. But I now, in the last 20 years, have actually been publishing in a field that's quite far removed from music scholarship. I've been mostly working on faculty development and administrative leadership in higher education. So that's where I publish primarily. For your listeners, and probably for you two, a lot more boring than what we've just been talking about. So.
that's all, like, I'm so fascinated by all of that, and it's such an interesting topic. But that isn't the topic that you came to talk to us about this week, though. Why don't you go into a little detail about what you're going to be talking about, and then we'll get to questions.
Sure. So my topic is on the whole, what I would call, art of publishing music, and why that art has unfortunately devolved in a digital age to an exchange system. And here I'm using Marxist theories of capitalism. And it really has devolved to an exchange system, unfortunately, for the creative artist. And what I mean by that is that publishing is no longer something that you merely reproduce on paper or even mass produce on paper to be sold for the education and enjoyment of learners in their homes. Because of the advent of radio in the early 20th century, and because of the advancements of electronic reproduction through sound recordings and through the electronic waves as amplitude modulated or AM radio is described, and then later as frequency modulated radio or FM radio is described, to our very earliest explorations with digital music in studios and the advent of the compact disc, which is digitally recorded music. We now have the ability, through both acoustic synthesis and through actual recording, sound recording, that is the analog form of recording converted to digital sound, to reproduce music in just about any form imaginable, whether it be compact disc, which is now a very antiquated form of digital reproduction, to MP3s, to a variety of other digitally based formats. And unfortunately, music as it is recorded by artists has become, in some arenas, in some markets, little more than a commodity to be bought and sold on a market. And I wanted to begin there because Marx's theory of exchange, of digital exchange, is something that critics and scholars, particularly in visual art and design, have long known would happen in arenas where commercial art is bought and sold. It wouldn't take long for what we perceive as the masterworks to be bought and sold. This is why you have outsider artists like Banksy creating temporary works that appear out of nowhere in the middle of the night. Banksy, whoever he or she is trying to prove a point that art cannot be bought or sold as a commodity because its value, its cultural value, becomes immediately debased. And so you create these temporary things that cannot be owned by anyone in a commercial sense and can be bought or sold. And so with music, we come today to music. I'm going to make an outrageous statement to you because I've talked about the sort of invalidation of paper publishing. The outrageous statement I'll open with is that music, particularly that reproduced in any digital format, is no longer owned by the artist and is in fact a commodity owned by whoever claims publishing rights. And I'm talking here not about paper, but I'm talking about electronic and digital rights to that musical product. Artists no longer own what they created. And in fact, sadly, music that is for sale on such markets is now a commodity to be bought and sold, just like any other work of art or any other piece of production, to use a Marxist term. And the composer has such a minuscule share of the profit of that work, if at all, that it is unfortunate that the artist no longer controls their own creation.
For sure.
Whoa. I hadn't thought of the significance of that.
Yeah, because like even in our
being blown right now.
Our business of music course that Linda ran a couple years ago, that was a big thing with like copyright and like streaming services and right. The minuscule amount that you get per stream of that and how like ownership over stuff is like constantly changing in the music industry.
Yes, and just to go specifically to that particular issue of streaming services, it's mostly where a composer is going to get streamed or noticed at all. If the streaming services play your music, and the average amount of royalty that comes back on a streaming service such as Spotify, I don't know if you remember this, Rogan, it's 0.04 cents per stream.
Mm-hmm.
Oof.
Very small. So you have to have something streamed at least 25 times to make 1 cent.
I guess the best way to support artists is play their music on Spotify on repeat, even if you're not using Spotify.
And I don't use Spotify. I purchase my music. We have lots of CDs, and it's becoming harder and harder to find artists in CD format. Mm-hmm. And we also listen to CKUA, and we support CKUA, so we hear some very, very interesting music there. Nice. We're also supporters of National Public Television, which is, of course, a partner of National Public Radio, and they also play a lot of emerging artists' releases, thankfully. You can't support CBC in the same way, because as a public national institution, it's supported by the government. I wish we could give CBC tons of money, because I've seen changes in the formats of CBC that I find disturbing. But I am very happy to hear the diversity that you can now hear on CBC mm-hmm. that you never used to hear. And it wasn't consumer choice. It was entirely up to the producers who got played, who got recorded. I mean, I'm dinosaur enough to have lived in an era where every month I would have music performed of my own, usually at a place called the Winnipeg Art Gallery in the Eckhart Gramaté studio, because I belonged to a number of composer collectives. And every month, one of those collectives would have a concert. And you were lucky if 50 people turned up to that concert. But faithfully, every time, because there was new music being premiered by a number of composers in any given collective, the Manitoba Arts Council would generously provide the funds for the performances to take place so that the musicians could be paid. And the CBC Radio Arts truck would be outside of the building with lines running into the Eckhart Gramaté Theater. And all of our music was recorded. There wasn't a single thing we wrote that wasn't recorded for CBC and then later played either on national or regional broadcasts. Those days wow. are gone. That doesn't happen and has not happened for at least 20 years, mm-hmm. to my recollection.
I didn't even know that that ever happened.
Oh, yes. So if anybody had, wanted to take the time or the effort to go through the CBC archives to see what's still on analog tape, because it wasn't digital tape, we're talking about the early 90s, late 80s and early 90s here, they could probably find reams of stuff if they haven't thrown it out or converted it to digital at this point. But yes, every region was responsible. It was part of their mandate to compose, record new composers' works, and they would faithfully be broadcast at some point. Now we are fortunate to have one CBC program between the hours of 5 and 6 on the AM band on Saturdays that records new Alberta artists. And these are not what you would call at all concert music composers. They are popular artists, and that's all that CBC does.
Between 5 and 6 a.m. or p.m.?
P.m. In Alberta, it's called the letter A or something like that. The program. There's an A in it anyway. And I listen to it because I want to hear what's new coming out from Alberta musicians who do like the folk festival circuit and other sort of popular music realms. Even country artists like Corb Lund are featured on that show. And it's important to kind of keep up with what's new. And CBC also has a contest that runs every year called Searchlight. You may have heard of Searchlight, mm-hmm. where new bands, new artists mm-hmm. are featured, and the popular music public listen and they vote for their favorite artists. And the CBC is still a sponsor of the Juno Awards, which crosses all genres and specters of music, but there is not the attention to specific genres of music that there once was, and no composers get commissioned by the CBC anymore. No composers are recorded regularly by the CBC for regional or national broadcast. None of their music gets performed except on CBC FM, and it's squeezed in between a usual sort of programming fare. It's whatever the host and the host's producer decides will get performed. So it's accidental.
Do you think that the shift was like societal? Like this is just what consumers want, and so that's what the music industry provides? Or do you think that there was some major players or producers who thought that they could make a lot of money off of vulnerable artists?
The cynical side of me says that it's all producers who decide what get aired on particularly radio that is considered public in some form. In Canada, of course, public radio is government funded. And so producers very much bow to the will of what CBC listeners are listening to. They listen, they pay very close attention to what streaming services are playing, because that in fact indicates demand. And in the States, because public radio is publicly funded, they're hearing requests all the time. And CKUA, to my knowledge, is the only public-funded station in Canada, now more than 100 years old, that is broadcasting across the country and around the world via the digital realm. But they play requests, and they publish their playlists. So you know what they're playing, and you can find out who the artist is, and you can either, you know, track down that artist through their websites or whatever, or you can request more of their music via CKUA. But they don't play a lot of classical music. Again, CKUA has 1 hour devoted to the classics on Sunday afternoons, and it's mostly white German dead guys. Yeah. And no offense to any of the other composers, but that is in fact what is requested. And people know that that show is probably one of the only places where they're going to hear their favorites broadcast, except on CBC FM.
Yeah, it's interesting, like, especially talking about, like, the physical media portion of that. Like, I'm pretty thankful that, there has been these resurgences in, like, people who buy CDs and people who buy vinyl and stuff and, like, a whole bunch of physical media.
Right.
But then on the other side of that, like, bands and, like, artists and composers and stuff, it's become more of, like, a storefront than an actual, like, creative outlet. Because, like, in order to get by and make anything off of their works, they have to have a whole bunch of merch from, like, shirts and bags and hats and... And yeah, like physical media, rather than like just putting their music out there and like having it like it available in print.
That's right. And, you know, so it really does make the small publisher like myself almost a trace factor. Yeah, I have merch too, and I make sure that when I do trade shows, that I have the merch out front and center, because that's what attracts people to the table. And then they see what you have on display. And of course, if you talk about niche markets, selling paper copies of music is a niche market to begin with. Mm-hmm. Selling paper copies of composers who are Canadian composers, number one. And number two, who write music primarily for concert performances and for music educators, is a very, very niche within the niche market. And then selling music that is essentially going to be used in private music studios of piano teachers, voice teachers, and some string and woodwind teachers makes it a niche of a niche of a niche. So it's very, very small. Mm-hmm. And I knew that going in. I wasn't blind to that. I've been a composer. I have music published by other publishers. And I know that there is no market for it. But for the composer, it is very important. And it's not for the royalties, which are very small. And I pay massive royalties by comparison to the Spotifiers mm-hmm. out there. Because I believe, and one of the reasons the company exists, is that composers need to have compensation for their work. 40 years ago, it was public knowledge in Canada that a composer's salary relative to the work or the time that was put into creating work was about, on average, a 4% return. So on the dollar and the time, if you multiplied the time at a fair market wage spent creating a work of art, you would get through composition grants, what we call commission grants, and through any sales of your work over a lifetime, about 4% back on that work. And that was in the 80s, right? So I know that it's a lot less now, 40 years later. I believe that it's very important to support artists because I fear what happens within the culture when we don't support artists.
You mentioned a few ways to support artists so far, like listening to CPAUK.
CKUA.
Thank you. And like buying the music on CD or vinyl, obviously, but are there other ways that we could support our local artists?
Well, if you teach music, find the sources of where the music you teach is published and buy it. I alluded earlier in my very opening comments to the unfortunate situation that the pandemic found many music teachers in, having to revert to Zoom for all of their lessons. And if they had any kind of digital supports to teach their lessons, they would likely be resorting to uploading attachments of music they owned because their students wouldn't be going out to buy it necessarily. Mm-hmm. Or they wouldn't be selling it through their studios in hard copy. And every time a published work is uploaded as an attachment, it's one less opportunity, this is putting it kindly, for a musician to actually make royalties off of a sale of music. So let me tell you how my commercial operation works. And here I'm not talking about sales that are made to individuals like music teachers or composers, or students rather. I am talking about commercial music vendors like Long & McQuaid, for example, who's one of my regular customers. I have a number of other major commercial buyers, mostly in Eastern Canada, one of them out of the city of Toronto that buys regularly, and another one out of Ottawa that buys regularly. Tom Lee has been an occasional customer as well, but Long & McQuaid is far and away the biggest one. And when they order from me, I give them a massive discount. They are able to buy my music at 50% of what I retail on my website. And I do that so I am able to afford paying the 20% commission for the sale of each of those works that I sign in my contracts with every one of my composers. So it's a plus all the way around. People buy legal copies of the music that is copyrighted, and the copyright is shared between the composer and me. They pay full price for the music that Long & McQuaid buys if they buy it in the store, or they pay full price if they buy it from me on my website. Long & McQuaid, as a distributor, does not lose by getting a discount, and the composer does not lose because I ensure that 20% of what I make through the sale is paid back to them. And they are able to get more from me as the copyright holder with them, the profit side of their copyright, if you will, than they would get from pretty much any other publisher. I know of no other publisher who pays 20%.
I mean, that's a good commission rate, really, even commission in like a regular sales job.
And if their work was recorded on disc or for any kind of streaming service, as you know, they would get 0.04 per play. So very, very small potatoes. It's another way of getting their music out there, and that's why they do it.
What a beautiful relationship.
So I'm looking for new composers all the time, and of course I'm going to vet them, but and I will say it's the new composers that have signed on with me that get the 20% royalty. I don't pay my older composers 20% unless they re-sign with me, and I've got a bunch of them that are re-signing with me this year because their copyright contracts have run out. So they will get the 20%, and that will be a surprise to them, because most of them are used to a 10%, which was also a very generous payout, but that wasn't really giving them enough in terms of sales. And I will also disclose that many composers' works for which I hold copyright are long deceased, and it's their estates that control their copyright contracts. That would be in perpetuity until 75 years has passed since their death, right? And then, of course, work becomes public domain. And so we're very careful to watch those dates, because I can only hold the copyright to a work until 75 years after a composer is deceased. And I hold a number of very important composers' copyrights with the estate of that particular individual and with the permission of the estate holder. Some composers or their estates have withdrawn my permission to hold their copyrights, and that's perfectly within their purview to do, right? So I'm not giving them a special break until contracts are renewed. It's at the signing of a new contract or at the renewal of a contract where I will offer that amount. And with the composers whose copyrights are very rare and unique, the 20% is a good incentive for them to re-up with me. And I know that, but I also know that I will save a composer a lot of shopping around, because they know. They know what other publishers are offering. So I've actually had people move from other big publishers like Alfred, who you'll see in every music store with their series of books from beginner, pre-beginner, right up to, you know, senior levels. I've had people switch from Alfred to me as their publisher because they want the smaller publisher.
What did you say the name of your publishing company was again?
Palliser Music.
Palliser Music.
And I've only been around for 6 years. So I don't have a lot of method books. I don't have any method books. We don't do that. But I don't have a lot of books in stores, except if Long & McQuaid chooses to buy them, and they usually buy one or two copies at a time, sometimes five, depending on how much demand there is. And people will purchase the music largely because they see the Royal Conservatory has the piece on their exam list. Mm-hmm. Or Royal Conservatory has paid me a fair dollar to actually have these pieces reprinted in their Frederick Harris Celebration Series books, their grade level books. So we've got pieces that are on loan to the Royal Conservatory for all grade levels, for piano, voice, and some string and wind publications as well. Yeah, these are time limited. They're beyond the regular publication, and they pay me essentially a lease fee for these works. The lease term is usually 7 years, because every 7 years the Royal Conservatory will renew its books. So every time a new Frederick Harris publication of a level 8 piano or a level 10 voice comes out, if I have something in that book and they decide to keep it for the next issue, they will contact me and we will renew the lease.
Wow.
Very cool.
I didn't know anything about music publishing or anything before this at all.
So these are all new pieces of information for you. And you know, it's good. It's good to know these kinds of things. But it's such small potatoes in the world of music transaction, let's call it that, because it really is all about the commerce, right? How the music mm-hmm. is used and consumed in the wider public, that is important. And unfortunately, during pandemic times, teachers have not been able to retain a kind of a legal mode of transaction with their students. Mm-hmm. There just has been no way to do that. They've been breaking the law all over the place because they're sending scanned uploads of files to their students.
Because I guess what are you going to do?
If you mail legal published copies of that work to your students, that's one thing. But I rather doubt that that's going on.
Yeah.
It's just so convenient to scan it and upload it on the computer, right?
It costs money, and the teacher has already paid for the score that they're scanning. So they figure, because they don't know what they're doing, it's okay for them to just simply send one scanned copy to the student. But it's funny, because once festivals begin again, once exams in front of an examiner in a real room begin again, there are going to be an awful lot of teachers that will just email me in a panic. And they will want to have music sent to them very quickly. And of course, I send it to the teacher. The teacher pays for it, and they're able to bill the student for that music, which is often the way things happen. Because the students don't know where to buy or how to buy or whatever. Occasionally, I'll get a student whose parent will go online and buy a score from me for a festival or an exam. I'm sorry, you may be hearing my dog panting in the background. She just came in from a walk. Can you hear it?
She's good, though.
What's her name?
Her name is Millie. She's 10 years old, and she's a lab, so she just moves very slowly through the world, and when she gets taken out for a walk about 3 or 4 times a day, she comes in and just pants like the world is going to end.
She's
on a nice, cool floor, so I think she may cease in a minute or two.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry about that.
Okay. Well, that's okay. I guess looping back to music publishing, we have one more question for you, but it's a big question, which is, what do you think the future of music publishing will look like post-pandemic, but also after the pandemic? Like, what's going to happen?
I think the future of print music will experience a bulge. The market will probably be quite active for about 1 to 2 years, because there will be a real desire for people to hold music from a legitimate publisher again, and people will want to see what's out there that's new, that they can use to replenish their studios or add to their studio collection. And certainly, the reason I say there'll be a panicked rush in front of a festival or an exam mm-hmm. is that for every instrumental or vocal piece of music that's performed, the examiner needs to also have a legitimate copy. So everybody has to have two copies of the real thing. There can be no photocopies at exams or festival performances. So yeah, we're going to sell quite a bit of music once the world comes back to life again. And people will do anything to get their hands on copies of things that they can't get otherwise.
Oh, I'm excited for you.
That's right. And because I hold the copyrights to pretty much all of the piano music and vocal music that's out there for junior musicians up to advanced levels. There'll be some pieces they can't get anywhere else except from a local distributor who has to buy it from me. So I can see that there's going to be an uptick. There will be a real kind of flat line, I think, in the streaming industry. Because a lot of people want vinyl. Yeah. They're buying hard copies of things again, as Rogan alluded, and any stores that have been open that have taken the gamble to sell vinyl of a lot of new artists that are emerging, you know, that have been heard on CKUA or wherever, have gone to the record stores where these things have been on display, and perhaps on sale, and they've been selling out. Vinyls have been selling out all over the place. You know, there'll be a pressing of maybe 10,000 copies of things that, for example, The Tragically Hip just released a new album, and they just got pressed on vinyl. I know they did some digital pressings too, but the vinyls are sold out. You can't get them anywhere.
Wow.
And, you know, there are reasons for that, obviously. It's an homage to Gord Downie, and they've invited a bunch of guest artists to come in and do the solo work and to reinterpret Gord Downie. So people want that, you know. It's an item that's in demand, and the supply has been completely outstripped by demand in this particular case. So I think you're going to see a bump of sales of CDs and vinyls, and there'll be a flat line of things like Spotify, other streaming services for a while. And Spotify will be under scrutiny by the federal government, by other agencies who look out for the rights of composers, because there's been enough of a hue and cry that the Copyright Act in Canada needs updating. It hasn't been updated since 1949. And
that's too long.
It's totally outdated. There were a couple of small additions made to it in the late 80s, but it's still not enough to cover what needs to be covered since the explosion of digital music in any form.
Yeah, now that we're in a digital era, things are so different. Like, nobody's protected by that anymore.
I predict that Spotify is not going to be able to get away with what it has gotten away with in the recent past. And even so-called record producers or CD producers are not going to have the controls they once had over marketing an individual artist's work and over the sale of individual artist's work. And, you know, right now the producer is the copyright holder in recorded music.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an organization in Canada essentially around it's called the CMRRA. It is around the Canadian Music Recording and Redistribution Association. And I get royalties from them too. Every time I have a work that's broadcast on radio or that maybe is streamed, they are owed royalties for all of the artists that are members, all the producers, all the record producers that are members of their organization, and they must pay. The amounts they pay are very small, very small. And it's sometimes over as much as a 5-year period, depending on how they set their regulations. But I think we're going to see an uptick in actual hard copy music and in physical objects that can be held in the hand that come with program notes and things, because people are interested in that. We may see a flatlining of the streaming industry, particularly on the pop music side, because people are tired of subscription services.
I look forward to the day when the power and money is back in the hands of the artists.
Yeah, I don't know if that's ever going to happen to the degree that we hope, but some of us have to keep trying. Yeah.
And I find too, especially like every artist like signed to a small label is like going to have a vinyl release for their artists. Well, not necessarily a small label, but anything that's decently sized and like to the larger ones, they're going to have all the physical media
for
all of their artists. And I find that it's interesting. Like I don't know if Spotify will ever like take a huge dip and like other streaming services, but definitely like the resurgence of people who have like taken the power into their own hands to actually like hold on to physical media while still streaming just so that they can support the artists. Like, I find that recognition that, hey, this is going more directly straight to the artists and supporting them in making new music for us. Like, that has seen a huge rise in coming years. And, like, especially, like, 2020 was, I think, vinyl surpassed CD sales. And that's huge, like, to see that rise in that. And then, like, a bunch of people who still, like, purchase CDs and even like physically like purchase digital recordings. Like, there's people through like Bandcamp who like go for the more like the higher audio recordings so that they can hold it digitally and not have the space taken up by a physical media, but are still like directly supporting the artist. So that's been a very interesting turn of events, and I'm hoping that will continue to rise in the future, and like projected it will be.
Like, my personal strategy for my favorite albums is to buy merch or something from that artist or band, or a copy of the album physically, but then I love my streaming services, then I don't feel as guilty streaming the album on Spotify or wherever.
Paying a small portion of what, you know, should be, right? Even if you're
my 0.04 cents.
Even if you're paying like whatever it is, $9.99 to Apple every month or something like that, you know, you're still iTunes, you're still getting, you're paying something. And that's the important principle. Back to what you were saying though, Rogan, what you're describing is, I'm calling it an underground movement. And by time that it happened, that in fact, artists are becoming much more cognizant of who their real markets are, because when they play the circuit, whatever live audiences they play to, they know who buys the merch, because they usually get some kind of information from you. They have a fan base and they want to cater to that fan base. So they will be able to distribute hard copies of their recordings and people will buy them. And that is very much what we would describe across all commercialization as the democratization of art, right? We're bringing the artist, in a sense, directly in contact with the consuming public, and there is no middle person. And when you can autograph your hard copy of whatever, even better. You've got a tangible thing in your hand that you've held that said, not only have I listened to this artist, but I support this artist, and there's no middleman. Mm-hmm. And there's so much,
it's beautiful.
There's so much middle right now in the commercial distribution of music that I'm just thrilled. I'm delighted to see that we're going back to a more direct connection between the artist and the supporting public, because there are so many different publics that support different artists that we would never ever see. They would be erased if every piece of music we ever accessed was via digital streaming services, and it could go that way. So I'm very happy to see the backlash, and we can thank the pandemic in part for bringing that about. It was already starting to happen, but I think the pandemic has actually, because there haven't been live concerts This has been the next best thing. I can hold a piece of this artist if I can't see them, right? This has been the next best thing to actually having that contact, that personal connection that is so needed for artists. Artists live. They feed off of that. It doesn't matter if you're composing a symphony in a lonely garret somewhere or if you are playing gigs every weekend at a local coffee shop. You need that public to fuel your drive to create something that can be consumed. Not mass produced, but consumed.
So interesting too how like it seems like streaming services are becoming more and more of just a discovery tool, and then actually going out and purchasing the physical media is how you show your support. So
yeah, and wouldn't it be great if that continued? Mm-hmm. In some way, yes.
I'm really happy that there's so much optimism about the future of music publishing and streaming too. I was not expecting that.
No, and my sense is that's what is going to happen. You know, obviously very much on a smaller scale for people like me, but through distributors like Logan McQuaid, I think we're going to see an uptick of demand for more of the kinds of stuff that we produce and the copyrights that we share with the composer directly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh,
thank you so much for
that's such a
thank
nice
you so
thought.
Much for coming on, Linda. It's been very.
Oh, I'm happy to have done it, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's been a very insightful conversation. I love learning about all the stuff you have to offer.
So yes. Much.
Yeah. Every time we speak, I get that little tidbit of knowledge that like. Is going to really help me and I can maintain going forward. So thank
Good.
You.
Well, I'm grateful that that is the case. Thank you very much.
Yes. And this has been another one for the Archives. Thank you for listening to the Arcana Archives, an exploration into nerddom.
If you have any questions or suggestions for future topics or guests, please reach out to us at arcanacollective.archives@gmail.com.
Or follow us on Facebook or Instagram with the username @ArcanaArchives.
Hope to see you again!